Greetings, my name is Yitzchak Et Shalom, and it's my pleasure to be studying Megillat Esther with you. And now that we have completed the festival of Purim, it's time for us to wind up and wind down our study of Megillat Esther with the epilogue, the last three verses which comprise the 10th chapter of Megillat Esther. And in reality, we lost nothing by leaving this till afterwards, and I thought it might be advisable for us to all have an opportunity to hear the Megillah, experience Purim, and reflect back on some of the questions that I raised during the earlier podcasts, and then have a little time to think about them, and then come together to try to resolve them. So we will do three things over the course of this relatively brief podcast. First of all, we'll read the last three verses and translate and explain what's going on. Talk a little bit about some of the overarching questions that were raised in earlier podcasts, and then suggest several general directions for understanding the Megillah, along with perhaps one or two specific answers to the questions. So first things first. Vayasa Melech Achashverosh Mas al Haaretz V'iye Hayam. The very end of the Megillah reports something which is relatively bad news for everybody in the Persian Empire, which is that the king placed a tax, mas is really a poll tax, over the land and over all of the islands. Famous suggestion of the Gaon Mivilna, we know from the very first verse in the Megillah that there were 127 provinces in the Persian Empire. That also shows up in other books of Tanakh with other emperors, and he suggests that the word mas, which the numeric value of which is 100, and ve'iye, and islands, the numeric value of which is 27, so that there were 100 provinces that were on land and 27 by sea. An interesting observation, one that's not supported by the evidence of where the Persian Empire spread, but nonetheless something that's enjoyable to see here at the end of the Megillah. If you are looking directly at a text in the original, you will notice that the ketiv, meaning the form of the graphic form in which Ahasuerus's name is written, in this one instance is different than it is through the Megillah. It's still read Ahasuerus, and we have that phenomenon of kri uchtiv, which we didn't discuss in this series. We talked about a lot in the series on Sefer Shmuel. But you notice here that you have the name Ahasuerus, which seems to be the way it's written. And truth to tell, this seems to come closest to however it was originally pronounced in Persian, such that the Greeks wrote it with a chai, and an epsilon, and a rho, and a chai, and an epsilon, and a sigma, Xerxes. But we pronounce it Xerxes, but remember that X letter, is chai, is really something more like ch, or kh. So that they were probably coming as close as they could with their dialect to the way that it was said in Persian, and that may be reflected by the Ketiv here. In any case, the big tax that Ahasuerus put over all the provinces may be an allusion to some of the military efforts that Ahasuerus was involved in, and if indeed, as we surmise, Ahasuerus is Xerxes I, who ruled from 45 to 465, then, as has been documented in many places, he did indeed have a very significant military campaign in the West, where a famous battle against the Spartans, and eventually he made it to Athens and burned Athens before he was beaten off. And that may be the reason for this tax. Why it's mentioned here is a little bit beyond us. In any case, the last two verses describe the greatness of Ahasuerus in relation to Mordechai, as opposed to the opening verses of the Megillah, which describe the greatness of Ahasuerus on his own. So all of his power and his might refers to military victories. And the whole story of the greatness of Mordechai, Asher Gidlo HaMelech, which is the same phrase used at the beginning of chapter 3 in reference to Haman. Again, Mordechai stepping into Haman's shoes. The author here is referring us to a book that we do not have access to, but evidently at the time of the completion of the Megillah, was an accessible text. It says, if you want to read more about Ahasuerus, and you want to read more about the greatness of Mordechai, go look in the Chronicles of the Kings of Madai Upharas. This is not the only case. There are many cases of books referred to in the Tanakh that we do not have access to. The Ibn Ezra's comments in Bamidbar about Sefer Melchamot Hashem is a place to start the inquiry. The reference to Sefer HaYashar that shows up twice, once in Yehoshua, once in Shmuel Bet. This reference to the Sefer Divrei Mimalchei Madai Upharas. Throughout Melachim you have Sefer Divrei Mimalchei Yisrael, which we do not have. There are several others, including the Mishpat HaMelucha that Shmuel wrote, as presented in Shmuel Aleph Perek Yud Bet, are again references to books that were available at the time, but that we do not have access to. That list is Ibn Ezra's take. It seems to be the simplest read of those many psukim. And in any case, the ultimate pasuk, the final pasuk, Ki Mordechai HaYudi, Mishnel HaMelech HaChashverosh. And finally, at the end of the story, Mordechai achieves the same august position that in an earlier generation Yosef, as Mishnah Lamelech, achieved in the Egyptian court. The Gadol Yehudim, he is great for the Jews. V'ratzui l'rov echav, he is beloved or accepted by most of his brothers. Now Chazal have their take on it, and it's a subtle critique on Jewish involvement in foreign governments while in exile, in which they say that once Mordechai got involved in politics, many of the Sanhedrin avoided him. That's why he was only accepted by most of his brothers, not by all of his brothers. But this also reflects a reality. There's no such thing as a politician who has 100% approval rating, even among his own people. Doresh tov li'amo, he was seeking the welfare of his own people. V'dover shalom l'chol zaro, and peace for all of his children. And Hadron Halach, as we would say, Megillat Esther, we have completed our study of Megillat Esther, and of course we will return to the study of Megillat Esther, not necessarily in this format, but a little less than a year from now when we come close again to the holiday of Purim. In any case, looking back at the 10 chapters that we just completed studying, we know that there are a number of overriding questions which we, in some cases, suggested some answers to, in some cases left as open questions. Of course, the big granddaddy of all the questions in Megillat Esther is, where is God? And it isn't just that God is avoided and the document is written in something of a secular tone, but there are veiled religious references or allusions, or shall we say, a sense of the next phrase should be prayer, should be God, should be something of religious nature, and then it cuts off. The greatest example of that, of course, is in chapter 4 at the end, when Mordechai claims with such confidence that if Esther doesn't step in, salvation will come from, and you expect to hear from heaven, but instead from another place. And immediately afterwards, Esther's response is to have everyone gather and fast on her behalf, and it's understood that this fasting is a religious act, and yet religiosity is left off of the table. So these are difficulties which are rife throughout the text, and perhaps are a major part of the reason that there was the dispute about whether or not Esther should be included in the canon, or at least as a written text, should have the halacha of metameh tayadayim, the sugi of tumat tayadayim of kitvei hakodesh, about whether it defiles the hands. There are some interesting pieces that have been written lately about that, about the issue of Esther and tumat tayadayim. But the real question is, why is God not in the Megillah? If we begin with the premise that God is not in the Megillah because that is the author's orientation, the author's intent, that indeed God works through a veiled presence, but presence is not manifest and is not imminent in the text, then really we do have to go back to that question and say, what's it doing in Tanakh? This book doesn't belong in Tanakh. Tanakh is a collection of canonized books that we understand to be given to us through prophecy, through the direct prophecy of Moshe, through the less direct prophecy of the other prophets, through the divine inspiration, which is referred to as Ruach HaKodesh, and which reflects God's interaction with B'nai Yisrael. So before answering the question, we note that there is a whole other piece of Megillat Esther that doesn't fit the rest of Tanakh, and that is the absence of Eretz Yisrael as a focal point, as a place to be exiled from, although that's the one reference, but that's not a major focus, certainly it's a place to come back to, and that's the great disappointment at the end of Megillat Esther, that at the end of the story, Bnei Israel do not respond and return en masse to Eretz Israel. They stay comfortably in Shushan, and but now as openly as Jews. This is very troubling. Two other questions that I raised at the beginning of our study. One which seems to be trivial, and that is the abundant use of a new word, a word that does not appear in Tanakh much before this, and it's a word that comes to us from the Old Persian, and that is the word of dat, dat, which means protocol or custom, and as I mentioned, over centuries changed to mean first belief system and then religiosity in the modern verbiage. But the word dat shows up over 20 times in the Megillah. Why? And the datot that are mentioned are so strange. A dat not to make people drink, and a dat of what to do with a queen who rebels, and a dat that anybody who comes to the king without being summoned is killed unless the king's in a good mood, and a dat to kill everybody in Shushan today. Very bizarre references. And the last thing that I'd like to address, just in this in the time that we're allowed here, is all of the references throughout the Megillah, chiefly in the first chapter, but also in the fifth chapter, and in the sixth chapter, of phrases and words that remind us in a very obvious way of the Beit HaMikdash. The Zahav, the Kesef, the Tchelet, the Argaman that are described in the first chapter in the party of Achashverosh, the 180 days, which is, according to our tradition, about the time it was from the time Bnei Israel were commanded to build the Mishkan until it was constructed, until it was initiated from the day after Yom Kippur until Rosh Chodesh Nisan. The 7 days with the word malot of the 7 days of miluim at the end of that preparation period before dedicating the Mishkan, all of these just seem to be pointing very directly and very strongly to the Beit HaMikdash. The question is why? What is all of this about? And so we have four questions on the table, two which are very major, which is God's absence in any explicit way from the text, and almost, you might say, God's being censored from the text, places where we expect God to be presented and is X'd out, as it were. And Ibn Ezra, of course, I mentioned, has his answer to that. He says that the writers of the Megillah knew that this text was going to be circulated throughout the Persian Empire. They did not want the Zoroastrians to substitute Zoroaster for God and therefore induce more mention of a pagan god, and therefore they left it as a secular document. An interesting argument, and one that has much implication for the issue of church-state connections in all sorts of ways in Western society. But that's Ibn Ezra. And the question of the absence of any focus around Eretz Yisrael, the overuse, as it were, and the kind of strange and somewhat silly use of the word dat, and all of the Beit HaMikdash references. And I think that we can answer all of these basically together. As I mentioned, the introductory shir, the story of Megillat Esther happened somewhere in the middle of the 5th century, in the first half of the 5th century BCE, about 30 or 40 years after the Beit HaMikdash had already been rebuilt. And there was a small community that had returned to Yerushalayim. Read about it in Sefer Ezra, read about it in Haggai and Zechariah, the first 8 chapters of Zechariah. It was a small community, it was a poor community, and the Jews, for the most part, had very quickly adapted successfully and comfortably to Mesopotamia, whether it be under the Babylonians or later under the Persians and Medes, and were not interested in returning. And while there was a Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim that, as you can read in the first chapter of Haggai, was desolate and was ignored, and then you later read in Malachi, which is a period piece at the same time Megillat Esther, where the people are bringing pitiful korbanot to the Beit HaMikdash, at the same time we have these extravagant celebrations in the city of Shushan. And Hamelech, 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 throughout the king, who is the king of kings, and the Persian verbiage is Ahasuerus. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not to be found. And instead of the kavod and the tiferet, the zahav, the kesef, the tchelet, the argaman, the gold, the silver, the royal purple and the royal blue, the glory and the honor, that are all words associated with the Beit HaMikdash, instead these are words that are associated with Ahasuerus and his palace and his banquet, the time frame of 6 months and of 7 days, the use of the word bira, which only shows up in the context of Shushan and the Beit HaMikdash, Devarim Chavtet Pasuk, Devarim Aleph, Chavtet Pasuk Aleph, Chronicles 1, 29:1, Yerushalayim Beit HaMikdash is a bira, as is Shushan, seems to present us with, in the words of one of my teachers, the Tanakh and the anti-Tanakh. It's almost as if Megillat Esther is representing everything that the Tanakh isn't. Instead of divine monarchy, it's human monarchy. Instead of Yerushalayim, it's Shushan. Instead of the Mikdash, it's Shushan Habira. Instead of the Tchelet and Argaman, etc., of the Bigdei Kuhuna, it is the Tchelet and the Argaman of the finery of Ahasuerus. And there in comes the tale of the dat, the protocol, which is firm, which is just, which is not whimsical, which is unbending, and which is very real, which informs our relationship with the Beit HaMikdash, as the rabbis tell us, even David Melech Yisrael, if he walks into the Beit HaMikdash, he's not a Kohen, he is Chayav Mita, he's liable, for death, and the fact that he happened to write a good Perek Tehillim that day will not help, as opposed to Ahasuerus, who if somebody walks into the inner courtyard, another phrase which is used in context of the Beit HaMikdash in Yechezkel, somebody walks into the inner courtyard of the king, also is liable for death, unless the king's in a good mood and likes him and lifts the scepter, in which case he doesn't die. And throughout the text, the author continues to sting and make fun of the protocol and the law of this court, and to show how pathetic human monarchy in general, and the Persian court in specific, is, and as we note throughout our history, there have been different ways in which we have identified the weakness and the poor character of kingdoms that we observed or that we were under. In the case of the Romans, it was the brutality. In the case of the Greeks, it was perhaps their insistence on, quote-unquote, enlightening the barbaric East. In the case of the Persians, the poke consistently was at their appetite and at their whimsy, if you will. And that is something that comes throughout the Megillah. And so, in a sense, the entire Megillah, even at the end, is a very strong rebuke to the Jewish community that maintained its presence in Persia, that did not pick up and go to Israel, that preferred HaMelech HaChashverosh over HaMelech HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not in the Megillah, because you cannot have room for HaKadosh Baruch Hu if you've got HaMelech HaChashverosh. If you accept Ahasuerus as your king, there is no room for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore you have to find him between the cracks. You have to find him hidden in the Megillah. It is, of course, a very powerful and very strong message about survival in the diaspora, about strategies for survival, about the fact that Am Yisrael is going to be here nonetheless, and side by side, it also stands as a stinging rebuke. And to borrow the words of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi in the Mamar HaSheni of the Kuzari, that this is indeed our shame, that when the opportunity knocks, the kol dodi dofek, when the lover knocks on the door, and Am Yisrael does not get up in time to respond to the call, and by the time we open the door, the lover has fled. And that, perhaps, is another piece of the agenda of Megillat Esther, which really should be read on multiple layers and multiple levels, as understood only by those who know and love Tanakh, and those who study it in the original, as is the Nachala, the legacy of Am Yisrael. It has been a pleasure to study Megillat Esther with you, and we will meet again. But in the meantime, my name is Yitzchak Et Shalom. Everyone should have a wonderful day, and continue to study Mikra.